Okay, good morning. So today we'll talk a little bit about the question of how animals and organs get their shape. And when I say we, this is a group of people here at KITP. So now we'll cycle through. So Nick Knoll, Boris Schreimann, and I will walk you through this talk. And this is actually ongoing research, at least in the second half, in collaboration with the Princeton-based people. So Matt Lefebvre, who is a grad student of Eric Nischaus. So in the last week, you all already got a long introduction to what Drosophila is looking like. So it might not need that much of an intro. But what I think has only been started to looking at is how organs and embryos are actually getting their shape. But this question has been something that intrigued people over long times. So for example, Leonardo da Vinci pointed out that you can use very simple geometric shapes, such as circles and squares, to actually describe precisely when a human is well proportioned. And this idea of shape was taken up at the beginning of the last century by two seminal books. And these are not only scientific, they are actually also in literature. So for example, Franz Kafka published his seminal fiction novel called The Metamorphosis, where he takes his main character, Gregor Samsa, who is a salesperson, and makes him undergo a transformation from a human into a giant insect. And Kafka is this... Huh?
Six legs,
though? Well, he's not very specific about what kind of an animal it is, so it could also be a spider, and I think that there is also some artistic sort of interpretation to this. I just found this picture so stunning that I thought I have to put it up. Yeah?
How many people counted the legs immediately?
So Kafka is this extremely grim writer who finds that the life of this Gregor Samsa becomes extremely miserable. So all the people that he loves around him begin to sort of hate him. He falls into dismay. And to cut the long story short, he'll want to die in the end. And it's very dramatic. So it's a good short read. But it's a very grim perspective on this cool idea of being able to transform something. And of course, Darcy Wentworth Thompson gave us this book on growth and form, where he basically studies these ideas from a more scientific perspective. And so he's talking obviously a lot about growth, but in the end, he actually also has a chapter which he calls The Theory of Transformations. And in this theory of transformations, what he claims is that you can find some sort of a unifying principle for how shape might have evolved. And so he says that what you can do is you can take your favorite specimen, and you can take the favorite body part of your specimen, so in this case it would be the skull of a human, and you can draw it onto measurement paper. And now you can apply a transformation to this measurement paper where you basically narrow, you shorten these edges here, you lengthen these edges down there, you bend them somewhere, and as you deform the paper, you'll obviously also deform the object that you drew on it. And he claims that what you can find is such a transformation that this human skull could be transformed into the skull of a chimpanzee. So he actually claims that it is very general, that you can do this not only for humans, but that you can actually apply this idea over a large range of different animals, that, or even plants. You take one species, you find this local transformation, and then you will be able to change it so that it appears like a closely related critter. And so this idea was is very interesting and very exciting, and it was picked up by a local artist in Los Angeles, and he took these Pixar technology that you can use nowadays and made cranial renderings of a human and of a chimpanzee, and then he applied these transformations in 3D so that the human would turn into a chimpanzee and the chimpanzee would turn into a human. And what you can see in these videos is that clearly overall the pattern seems to somehow match, But you know, locally there are some mismatches. Like for example, these teeth you would clearly see if a human was around you with such long side teeth. Now, of course, he just had relatively simple transformations in mind, and you could use more complicated ones if you liked. But in the end of the day, it would work more accurately with these fine ones. A major criticism that you could give to this is that it is applied on adult tissues or adult organs. And it is clear that you will actually not go from an adult human into an adult chimpanzee. But he was very concerned with evolution. And we are thinking now, maybe we can apply similar ideas in development, actually. And so with these modern types of microscopes that Lars Hufnagel, who is here in the audience, that pioneered, we can actually see how an entire embryo undergoes this kind of shape changes, almost like this metamorphosis that Kafka has been describing, where initially we have 6,000 nuclei sitting on the surface, and then they are undergoing this extraordinary smooth transformation to change their shape. You begin to see segments emerging in this video, and then the germ band will retract, and by that time you will see that actually this animal has undergone a massive transformation in its appearance. And we've seen from Eric and Thomas in the last week that the embryo uses actually a very elaborate system of controlling gene expression in order to pattern the embryo and establish a coordinate system, if you like, on it. So here some of the key regulators are shown: bicoid maternal morphogen, which is deposited on the anterior side and forms this long-range gradient. Then there is a gap gene Hunchback, which is also maternally supplied. And then we can see here a gap gene called Krupel in pink, and a peril gene Eve that basically skips every other segment. And eventually, what this will lead to is a unique fingerprint in each nucleus of gene expression. And you can think of this, as Eric already pointed out, as some sort of a coordinate system on that embryo. But what we also know when we look at our videos is that these transcription factors that we can read out are actually all dynamic, right? As we look at this video, we can see that with the flow, as the flow is moving, these Eve stripes are also moving, and they are refining over time. So these dynamic aspects of the development need to be taken into account. And so the question that we would like to ask is how these global transformations that we see in the embryo can be instructed by this genetic coordinate system that we can observe. And so looking back again at this video, lots of observations have been made about this embryo in individual parts. So for example, Ken Irvine in the 90s had a paper on germ band extension where he very elaborately measured and showed that you can actually trace back how far the germ band extends on these different gap genes and on the peril genes. Eric and Adam Martin looked very closely at the ventral furrow. Thomas Lecuy only recently began studying the posterior midgut. But it is somewhat unclear how all these different parts together make this huge deformation. And so at the single cell level, we've heard from Suzanne and Johannes that these cells can undergo very particular kinds of changes in their shape, for example. They can grow and shrink or intercalate, which leads to deformations of the tissue. But still, this wouldn't explain to us how all these different tissue parts are actually going to interact with one another. And so what we would like to do is we would like to use an hypothesis-driven approach from physics where we can take our molecular picture about these myosin motors that people have described and try to bridge the gap between how is myosin distributed in an embryo and what kind of movements do we observe in the end. But looking at these data, it is also clear that we have a bit of a challenge in our way, and that is that such a movie can easily exceed what you can store actually on your laptop. So this movie, in fact, in its full size is about 2 terabytes in size, and I think LAS can produce much larger ones if you wanted to. So you need to find a way how you can actually generally, you know, handle this. And so to just give you some sort of an overview how that roughly works is, so your workhorse microscope is a confocal one, and we have lots of these in the school, and they are able to record around about 100 gigabytes of data in a day if they are used well, which means, you know, probably an external hard drive or things that you have are well suited to handle this. But if you take these light sheet microscopes, they can actually now produce much, much larger amounts. So 10 terabytes a day could be feasible, a bit less. But that also means that, you know, 1 week work on this thing is roughly 1 year worth of data that we produce on this other microscope, which means that not only do we need powerful computers directly on this machine to pull stuff down, but we also need some sort of creative way of storing our data. And so the main way of trying to come out with, and I think that is worked extensively on the field right now, is trying to use some sort of data compression. Yeah. So data compression itself is great because it reduces your data storage size and it will increase your data transfer rates, but it also comes with some caveats. For example, it comes with a caveat that, you know, it takes you longer to, you know, inflate the data again. And then there is this issue about lossy versus lossless compression. So you could lose information. For some exercises, this is not so bad. But if you want to measure fluorescence data, you'd rather not want to lose information systematically. And then one of the main issues is when you're looking at this is that, you know, in biology, layers, so tissues are often organized in layers. And these are entangled often. So you see this on this fruit fly embryo. Hadn't I been coloring this embryo in different depth indexes, so red is one side, blue is the other side, it would be very difficult for you to see how this embryo is rolling around. And so that is one of the key realizations that we had together with Itze, who is now teaching with Ari, and I think he's somewhere in the audience. So we designed an approach to reduce the data by reducing the dimensionality. And so the way we do this is we have our favorite data set, which, you know, usually is recorded in a cubic region of interest, which is this little grid here. And then we have our embryo sitting right in the middle. And as you can see, this grid contains a lot more pixels than the region that we are actually only interested in. Let's say we are interested in the apical surface of this epithelium here on the embryo, which is shaded in gray. Then the green stuff that is on the inside of the embryo, which is this yolk, is something that you know, might not be of immediate interest to our research. And clearly also the corners in this cube are also, you know, just storing space, and we actually don't use them. So the way that we can try to come around this is by saying, let's just try and extract the fluorescence data on a surface of interest. So we can define a smooth surface of interest in terms of a mesh. And then we can put a coordinate system onto this mesh. And as we have a coordinate system, we can have this coordinate system in the plane. And we can look at the fluorescence data also in the plane. And so all these ideas are implemented in the image surface analysis environment called IMSANE. So what we do is we take our embryo and we partition it into various different regions. So here this is an anterior fraction of the egg, that's a posterior fraction of the egg. And then here are cylindrical regions where we make different cuts indicated by these colors. These blue ribbons show you that these different regions have overlapping regions. And then we can make maps for these individual parts that we can see here, which are basically down here. So this is a view onto the anterior side. Here you can see the anterior midgut. That is the anterior midgut over there. Now this is a view onto the posterior side. You can see the posterior midgut there. And this here would be the internalized ventral furrow. And then here, this is a view onto a cylinder where we made a cut here at this green region. So now you can see the posterior midgut over here. Anterior midgut is here. This is the internalized ventral furrow, and that is the cephalic furrow. the power of this approach, and the similar approaches have already been done by this Atlas group in Berkeley, where they just did it for a Drosophila embryo, or also by Lars when we published this movie stem, which used this cylindrical map, is now that we can actually go across different maps too. So we can segment in each of these maps, each of these regions, and since we have transition maps, we can navigate and follow cells from one map into the other, so we would never need to go back into our real 3D data. But it has a disadvantage, or it has a caveat that you have to bear in mind, and that is when you look at segmented regions like this one over here, where you see basically this spot, you can very easily segment this whole data in one go, it gets distorted in other regions. Yeah, so if you look, for example, in this other chart of the anterior map, that's the same group of cells over here, and you can see that macroscopically this angle looks different from that angle, and also the overall shape of that same patch of cells looks different. But luckily, you know, the mathematics for this is around, so since we know the relationship between the three-dimensional surface and the two-dimensional maps, we can correct for these distortions and carry out all the measurements that you would want to carry out. So, for example, we can measure length of trajectories that we establish in these 2D maps, and then we can see if we are not correcting for distortions, and we measure it in, let's say, this track number one, in our posterior chart, here's the track number one, this is the highlighted track, we see that we get a significant deviation from the 3D measurement, and still in the cylinder we also would get some. If we correct for these distortions, it all comes in very nicely. And so now, the challenge is to go to a more general setting. So out of the Drosophila embryo, which was the simple example, we can now look at dynamic surfaces that are more complex in shape than, let's say, a Drosophila embryo. And so we use data recorded by Jan Hiskin's lab in Dresden, which shows a beating zebrafish heart. So in red you can see the myocardium, and in blue you can see the endocardium. And you can see that this heart actually does a full cycle of beats roughly twice each second. And so you can see how this atrium is pumping up and pushes the blood over here, and then starts the circulation through the fish. And so the challenge that we set ourselves is to see, can we extract this surface and apply the same kind of ideas that we can map the surface of a beating heart into the plane. And so since these triangulations that we use in order to represent the surface are fairly general, we can also recapitulate the shape of this heart, and we can also see that we can recapitulate the beating of the heart as a function of time. So we see how this chamber here inflates and this chamber here deflates. And then we can go and, just as we did in the embryo, partition the heart in different regions. And that can be done, you know, based on markers that you decide. So you say, I want to have N charts on this heart. And then you can also decide where you would like to have them, or we automatically compute them. And then we get, in this case, our four different regions. And then we can parameterize these different regions, and we can map them down into the plane. And you can see, as we mapped this beating heart into the plane, that it actually now becomes much, much easier to follow the movements of cells, such as these little nuclei that you can observe here, and you barely see the beat. The only way how you see the beat in this is by these dilations of all the content in this image. And then obviously we can ask, yes?
Yes, sir. Maybe I missed it, but how do you, so can you go back one second? So how are you defining the different regions? They're landmarks that you define on, say, time one, and then
we follow these landmarks.
And then you follow the landmarks.
Yeah, we follow these landmarks. So you can either say that you give some landmarks because you're interested in a particular tissue region.
Yeah.
Or the computer just gets a number of maps that you would like to have, And then you get random maps, but you follow always these maps throughout.
And can the regions grow and shrink, or?
So in this, when you look at this, this region, it is not exactly fixed size. There's some material flowing in.
I guess what sets that though? Is it?
Well, so what we do is we do a tessellation of the surface.
Okay.
And it is the tessellation of the surface that sets that.
Okay.
Okay, so then one thing that is also in this heart very clear is biology is then often organized in these multiple layers that are above one another, and so we can try to extract all these individual layers. So basically make a multi-layered surface of interest, where you can see here in white the original layer, and then like a Russian doll, we can basically expand or make the layers smaller, and so we have parts of a heart going through it. And then we can flatten each of these regions, and essentially what we then get is what we call Pringles. So you basically get a stack that goes through this region of the valve in the ventricle region of the heart. You can then sum these intensities, and just as we had this caveat with measuring areas and all these things, you'll also need to take these distortions into account when you're just adding up intensities in these measurements. And if we do this, we get perfect agreement with three-dimensional measurements. And then, you know, it allows us to perform very easily dynamic measurements on these curved surfaces, which would otherwise be a big challenge. Another advantage of this method is that now we can actually store a lot less. We need to store a lot less information about our data set that we are interested in. So what this shows is it shows the size of our atlas in which we store all our maps and the geometric metadata about the surface against the raw data size. And so, for example, for our fruit fly embryo, we could have an initial data size that is roughly 3 GB per time point. Then if we had a dynamic surface, so if we every time computed a new surface for our fruit fly embryo, the atlas would be in total about 80 MB in size. But if we can additionally assume that the surface of the embryo is static, which it is for large amounts of time, then you can actually reduce this much further and you get down to less than 10 MB of storage per time point, which means that your whole image is basically a lot smaller to save and to handle.
Do you do that on the fly, or do you have to do it afterwards when you store it?
So we do it afterwards when we store it. So what you do computationally is you get this data out of the microscope, you fuse the data sets, and I think Lars is going to talk a little bit about fusing them on the fly. And then we get one of these data sets, we extract the surface that we are interested in, and I think that's the main step where we can't do it on the fly because we need to know where is the surface in some way. Yeah. We do this by detecting this surface in image segmentation means, and then we fit this, and then it runs more or less automatic. So one step that you have to sort of input is involved.
And is a general strategy, is it permissible even from the NIH standpoint to throw out the original data and keep only the surface, only your reduction, your reductions?
So I think one of our referees was pointing out that we will not save a lot because the NIH doesn't allow you to actually save, you know, just that content. But, you know, you have to start thinking, right? So Thomas showed these very nice videos of the posterior midgut, where, or also of the lateral sides, where he basically just images the epithelium. And in all these imaging exercises, you never see the yolk. Now, my raw data is containing yolk, of course, yeah? But now the question is, what is actually raw data, right? So is raw data the pixel intensity that the camera gives back to me? Is it the currents that we get out of the camera? Or is the raw data simply the stuff that I have used in order to create my measurement?
Exactly, because otherwise, if you use a confocal, all that light that doesn't go through the pinhole. What happened to that light?
Yeah, what happened to that light? Where is it? I can't publish, yeah? So, yeah, that's...
The other issue, this will change, I think, but sequencing data, you keep the sequence you don't keep the intensity measurements as things go through the machine. And so the issue in defining what is, I think right now everybody's, I would throw out your raw data and keep only the reduction that you need, in part because it, you could put another wild-type embryo on the machine in 2 hours and get more raw data again. The proportion, the idea of what's hard, we used to think we should keep all our data because it might be useful to somebody else. And there's no way that somebody would prefer to use our old data versus the embryo that they put on the machine to collect the data immediately. So I think
Well, we'll have to see. So we still store our data because we want to publish. But I strongly agree with this perspective. So, yeah?
So this method you just described will apply when you have a clearly defined surface. But yeah. If I have an embryo that does not label apical surface, but only the cell-cell junction,
yeah.
then your method won't work. Because what I see is all the cell-cell junction, but there's no top.
Well, you could then go through your cell-cell junctions, right? So let's say you take Ekaterin as a measure, right? Ekaterin will also label virtually every cell in the embryo, and you can then find the junctions and then fit your surface through these junctions by the one or the other mean, yeah? So that works. As long as you have every part of your image somehow visualized, you'll actually be able to do this. Of course, if you take a tissue-specific marker that only labels the amnio serosa, well, then it's going to be a bit tough to get all the rest. Maybe autofluorescence will help us, but it's probably not going to be as nice as if you had been labeling everything.
But if I'm interested in, say, so for example, in Tasso's case, the germ band is embedded in the extra-embryonic yolk.
Yeah.
Then if I'm only interested in that germ band, is there a way to do that, or if I do this method, I'll just get the entire?
Well, so you can get the entire, and I think that Akanksha is using this stuff already on the Tribolium embryo to look at precisely the interface between these two things. So she looks at this cable, yeah? But of course you can design so that you only get this half part of the embryo. And then you don't fit the whole surface, but you fit just half of the surface. So there is a lot of flexibility. And I think we will give you an overview if you're interested in how it actually works hands-on. If the students are interested, we can do one session on how to analyze or how to work with this. Yeah?
Maybe I want to ask something. Projections and sections, I think it's very interesting because sometimes it really opens up your mind, because sometimes you see things from maybe a very limited perspective. But nevertheless, I was thinking, you don't think that now we're really moving towards quantifying in 3D? So
yeah.
Being able really to segment in 3D and then just say, okay, let's look at the apical region of this cell and what is
we'll the
surface?
We'll get to this. Yeah. We'll get there. Okay, so what then also is clear, all these image analysis methods that are around are perfected for two-dimensional data analysis. And so doing this stuff in 2D means that it runs much quicker. So you can read your data faster, you can filter your data faster, and you can do typical image analysis operations that usually on the full data set go to scales of minutes in seconds or even sub-seconds. And what is also cool is sharing your data over the internet becomes possible. I remember when we started this endeavor here, Matteo was trying to send us data from EMBL, and it was taking days to get the stuff over here. Yeah? So that's now this is essentially an email, or not an email, but a Google Drive or a Dropbox, and you can just download it. In fact, the students did it during the Elastic session. You downloaded a data set over the internet, everyone at the same time. And so one last thing I thought that would also be cool for the students. So we spoke about these curved tissues, right? But sometimes you analyze tissues that are next to nearly flat or not as strongly curved as others. And so, for example, Natalie showed these very nice movies of a imaginal disk of the Drosophila larva eye, right? So where this adult eye is going to develop. And what they are using is a marker that just labels the cell-cell junctions. So it's e-cutting, yeah? And what that does is it labels the epithelium of the disc, but it also labels the peripodial cells, which are some sort of a covering layer. And you can see them here nicely because they are different in their properties, like cross-sectional area. They are much bigger than the cells in the disc. And so what you can do is you can try to identify the surface of the epithelium and then just extract the surface of the epithelium. And then you can move your surface around, up and down, and then you can separate the epithelium from the peripodial membrane and have something that you might want to call virtual tissue markers. Yeah? And so the students in the 2013 course already applied, you know, an early version of the code to a wing disc, where we then peeled off basically this peripodial membrane artificially afterwards. Okay, so with all these methods established, we can now get back to our question about how does the embryo actually get its shape. And so we have this beautiful coordinate system, and we'd like to know how are these transformations of the embryo actually performed. And so one thing that we can do now with, for example, these cylinder projections is we can define some sort of a standard view on an embryo. Yeah? And so we can look at the embryo from a perspective where we map it onto a cylinder where we make a cut on the ventral side of the embryo. So the ventral furrow is up here and down here. The dorsal region is up in the middle center. Posterior region is here. Here you see the posterior midcut going in, and the anterior region is to the left. And so these landmarks, very coarse, basically show you the head here. This is the germ band region, that's posterior midcut region, and that is the region that will become the amnio serosa at some point.
Just to make it more intuitive, would it be possible to somehow color code on those images just how much the distortion is?
Yes,
in some way?
Yes, absolutely. That is possible. Yeah, that is absolutely possible.
So like expansion.
So in this map here, for example, you have a lot of distortion in these regions here and in these regions there. That's because the embryo becomes pointy there and we are mapping it out. We actually have generated maps that sort of are more favorable in these regions. They become pointy there. And these maps that are looking from the poles are also more favorable in this case if you're particularly interested in studying these regions.
Maybe even on such a thing, you could color code what the real cell elongation is. Say.
We can do that, yeah. So we can measure these cells, right? We can measure their cross sections, and then we can correct for these mistakes, and then we can actually show properly what size the individual cells are having. Yeah, absolutely. That's definitely doable. All right, so... and. Yeah.
I see. Do you do projections, which is not position-based, but it's tissue-based, because the tissue moves?
Yeah.
For example, the pole cells before, they're at the back, but then they're dorsally positioned.
Yeah.
So can you just do projection where the pole cells are every time point, so follow them and project them?
So I think, I mean, what we have here is a static surface. We defined a static surface there. We also have the capacities of doing a dynamic surface. And if we then have means of following the pole cells, you know, identifying them based on some like contrast change in the image, then we could actually follow the pole cells too. Yeah? And that would need, you know, minimal amounts of changes to what we have currently implemented and can be added. Yeah? So that's definitely possible. We've been, so if you look, some cells around about this region here actually undergo a shape change. They flatten out. Yeah? And so we sometimes lose them. And so if you wanted to do such a method, you could actually move towards greater contrast and deform your surface locally so that you have those guys always in focus. Yeah. So now you see how this embryo basically undergoes its development. You can see basically that initially there is some sort of a movement towards the dorsal side. You can also see that some nuclei seem to pop out on the dorsal side. If you focus on this region, around about 0 minutes, we begin to see this effect. Then we see these dorsal folds that Eric has been describing previously. You see the ventral furrow up here coming up at about 5, 6, 7 minutes. And we can see the posterior midgut folding onto the embryo. And so we can characterize this flow field, you know, or these movements in some coarse-grained manner by establishing a flow field. So I think that Suzanne and Johannes have described these ideas already. In principle, what you do is you look for how cells are moving from one time point to another, and then you generate a grid, and you assign in each position of the grid a little vector, which basically tells you where locally the tissue is going to move to. And when you look at this, you will see that this flow field on the embryo is actually relatively rich in structure. So you can see that on the dorsal side, we have mass flowing in from the posterior midgut and from the anterior midgut, and then we have cells moving towards the ventral sides. And this is called the hyperbolic fixed point, and likewise we have a hyperbolic fixed point on the ventral side, so these two are associated, where cell mass comes in from the dorsal side and then moves out onto the poles. And then here we have these striking vortices appearing, which are essentially, if you think about it, this germ band folding on top of itself, which generates this vortex-like structure. And you can then play this video over time, and you can see that we see this little movement onto the back that cells are doing initially, then they decide to turn around, make this ventral furrow, and then this pattern that I described to you gets established. And we can read that off across many different embryos and see how reproducible are these changes from embryo to embryo. And you can see that actually the dynamics is extraordinarily reproducible. Yeah. So if you align these embryos in time, then you can actually see that the change in dynamics overall in the embryo is much, much bigger than the deviation from embryo to embryo. And so now let's focus a little bit on this very early movement that we observe, where we see these cells moving onto the back of the embryo. If we are measuring, you know, or integrating the flow field from, let's say, 20 minutes before what we define as the onset of gastrulation, which is the first signs of a cephalic furrow, we actually observe that when we take the initial position of cells, that they are all moving very clearly towards this dorsal side of the embryo. And we would like to understand where that is coming from. And so what we saw from Eric last week in his overview talk is that there are these myosin pools on the medial side of cells, in the medial apical surface of cells, that are basically pulsing and getting this ventral furrow to internalize. Likewise, we've seen from Thomas Le Cuy that, and Jennifer Zahlen and others, that there are these strikingly polarized recruitment of myosin to AP interfaces. So we have almost cables running through the entire embryo, which show very high amount of myosin from top to bottom. And if you look at interfaces that are DV interfaces, you see very little amounts of myosin. And this is the mechanism that basically will lead to this T1 transition that I think Matteo showed very nicely, that these cells shorten and then elongate. And Thomas sort of set the stage now with his observations on the posterior midgut, where, you know, he looks at how do these different pieces actually interact with one another, how does the posterior midgut pull on the germ band. And so we have now a global perspective, and we can try to see whether we can understand how all these different parts are working with one another. And so myosin is clearly a major molecule that makes shape changes and leads to deformations of tissues and flow. And so what we have seen in these pictures now is when you look at the apical side, you can see very clear localizations of myosin. With these light sheet microscopes now, we can take the entire embryo, and we can also see now that at the basal surface of an embryo, you see a lot of myosin, actually. And this is 20 minutes before what we call the time that this starts. And of course, people, Eric has observed this before in cross-sectional stainings, but now we can actually do that dynamically. And what we can then see is that as this establishes, that we get a heterogeneity of this basal myosin pool. You can see that there's a lot more myosin on the basal side on the dorsal part of the embryo. Yeah, the dorsal is up. And on the ventral side, this myosin begins to disassemble. And we can also jump into the rest frame of this moving front. And then we can also see this very clearly, that in the center, which is the dorsal view, we have a lot more myosin than on the ventral regions of the embryo. And so we can try to quantify this, or we can try to measure this, and assign some sort of an anisotropy for, or heterogeneity measure for that, which basically shows that over time, as we go towards zero in this movie, we have a lot more myosin on the dorsal side. This is just the same kind of picture unrolled than we have on the ventral side. And we can see that it builds up, that at about the time that we define as the onset of gastrulation, we have the maximum heterogeneity, most dorsal myosin at the basal side, and that this lasts for about 10 minutes, and then it begins to die out. And so the idea could be that what this pool of myosin is doing, it actually pulls cells onto the dorsal side, which would explain this dorsalward movement that we are observing. And so what we can do is we can try to measure the tilt of cells. We can look at how cells are tumbling and ask whether the basal side really is the side that might drive the movement. Yeah? So the idea is basically you have a direction of the flow that we are observing, and you can ask basically if the basal side is leading. We give this a red pointer, then a neutral pointer if they are both the same, or if the apical side is leading, we give it a blue pointer. And what you can then see in this video here is that initially we see that the basal side seems to lead the flow, and then, this was intended to loop. And then it changes such that the apical side is taking over. And when you quantify this, you can see that this happens right about 5 minutes after the onset of gastrulation, which is when the ventral furrow actually internalizes, where we see then this very strong myosin pools that Eric has been describing. But what we also see at the end of this video, let me see if I can play this to this position, is that we have a striking contribution at the back, where the basal side still seems to lead the flow. And so the question could be, is this because the basal side is just getting pushed in by the posterior midgut, right? So if the posterior midgut were to push, the basal side would also go forward, right? So what we can do now with Matt and Eric is take these torso-like embryos, which basically do not make a posterior midgut, and then we also observe that these cells are still doing this movement onto the dorsal side, and we can watch that over time. Now they also begin to initially make this little mill, but then the embryo begins to twist and develop in a different way from the wild type. Okay, so let's see if we can try to...
Can you repeat exactly this upper movement you're talking about? Which movement are you...
So you remember the cells are moving onto the dorsal side of the embryo. We're observing that on the basal side of cells...
Before furrow formation.
Before furrow formation already, and until furrow formation, they are doing basically this. And then when furrow formation happens, they change, and then what you have described is happening, right? They basically walk onto the ventral side, yeah? And we observe that this process goes hand in hand with this heterogeneous distribution of myosin, where we have a lot of myosin basally on the dorsal side and less on the ventral side.
So during this process, there are cells blowing up to the dorsal side and also a cell being squeezed into the ventral view.
So that, yes, these processes are going hand in hand. The squeezing into the ventral side starts at about 5, 6, 7 minutes, and it goes for another 5 minutes, I think. And then these cells are internalized.
Is there any correlation between the myosin II level and the curvature of the embryo? Is the myosin II level higher where the curvature is higher?
It's a very interesting question. So we haven't measured it yet, but we would be excited by doing it downstream. I mean, what we are right now excited about is trying to see if we can actually understand. I said, can we bridge this gap between this molecular distribution of myosins and the movements that we are observing on the global pattern. Yeah? And so for this, we can go to the concept of stress. And so the idea is we go to our favorite little region in the embryo, and we blur out a little bit. We don't think about individual cells. And we think about molecular forces that can tug on interfaces. Yeah? And so let's take a look at an idealized box and say that we have an X interface and we have a Y interface, and then we have a force acting on that X interface in the direction X and in the other direction. What this will do to this little box is it will elongate the little box. Yeah? Now we can go and repeat this exercise. We can take the same force acting in the X direction, but we have it now tugging on the Y interface. What this will do is it'll shear the interface, right? So it'll just do this tilt. So this means for the simple Gedanken experiment that in order to describe, you know, the all the ways of how forces can tug on this little square, we'll actually need four numbers. And these four numbers are collected in something that you call stress tensor. And then if you are interested in the forces that are acting on our little box of interest, what you need to do is you need to add up all these forces, and then all these molecular forces, these stresses, and that turns out to be the divergence of this stress tensor, and then we have an idea for what forces act on them. So we would now like to know what are the molecular candidates for these stresses that would generate forces acting on the cells. And so
you're not distinguishing between an external force acting on that patch of that on your square versus an in.
Yeah, I mean, right now we are doing this very locally. Yeah? We will build a very local picture where we have just our local myosin contribution tugging onto the cells. And you will see that this local picture is going to semi-work. And then we will develop, you know, that we have longer range effects incorporated into our model. So the hypothesis would be that we say that our stress tensor is some sort of a tensorial quantity that we can construct out of the myosin that we can measure. And the test for this model, whether it is good or not, would be to say, can we compare the dynamics in the embryo to the divergence of these snapshots of myosin that we are getting? And if we get good agreement, then that model might work. If we get poor agreement, then that model might fail.
What do you mean by MIJ?
So MIJ is a tensor that we will construct. I will get there. So it's just an idea, you know, that it's a function of myosin, and we need to see how we can actually make it. Yeah, we will get there. So basically, on the apical side, we know that myosin is polarized. And we can try to go the way that we segment the entire image that we are getting, and then extract mnemonics, like Frank and Suzanne have done that. However, on the data sets that we are having here, this becomes very challenging. I mean, for one, you know, there are 6,000 cells on this surface. It's multiple different time points. Then we would like to be able to repeat this over many different embryos. So this is becoming a very big challenge, and we all know how hard it is to actually segment myosin. Yeah? So you would want to have a counter stain or things like that. But if you only have myosin, we can still construct some sort of a measure for the polarization of this myosin. Yeah? And so the way we do this is we use a radon transform, which essentially maps a local region into a space that parameterizes each line by an angle and a distance to an origin. And out of this, then, we can extract the average intensity along this line, and we can extract the orientation of each of these edges.
Sorry, what is this line that we're seeing?
Yeah, so you see this myosin cable running here, right? Now let's go into a little box here and make a radon transform in this little box. What this will do is it will pick up where this...
So
the radon transform takes an image and basically maps it into a space that parameterizes the image as a function of distance to the origin in this image that the line had and the orientation that that line had. So this image that has a line becomes a peak in the radon transform, just a dot. And finding this dot is much, much simpler than really finding this line accurately in using segmentations. Yeah? And I'm happy, you know, if people are interested in using that technique, we can make a sort of session about that.
Sort of like a autocorrelation function?
No, it's not a correlation function. So what you can do is imagine that you have this line here, right? And now imagine a little line that you could rotate around, yeah? And you integrate all the signal along this line for all the times. This line always has a different angle. Then at some point it will be highest.
Okay.
Yeah? And if you move it into the other direction, you move it around, it will never be high. And that's how...
On the length of the lines, you sort of try different lengths of lines and then...
Yeah, so no, you do this for the length of your entire box that you're interested in. And if your cell is not entirely contained, or your edge is not entirely contained, then you can cut and limit it to the length of your edge. And then you can divide the total intensity that you integrated along this line by the length of that particular edge. Yeah? And the real advantage of this method comes into the game because we can now run this in basically no time over the whole image. So something, you know, segmenting this image would take us a long time. Using this radon transform on my laptop, it takes significantly less than a minute.
So I would like to understand what you do. So is the idea to make, if you would be able to know the orientation of mice into mini filaments, would it be what you need for this tensor?
Yeah, so we get there. We get there. Yeah, we get there. So I wanted to first build, you know, how do we extract myosin information?
Yes.
Yeah. So this myosin information on the apical side, we can basically say we get the average edge, and we get the orientation of this edge. Now we have the orientation. Now we can dot them into one another, and then we basically construct a tensorial object out of this. Yeah, which is basically can be decomposed then into a trace and into a traceless part. Okay, and so now we have this measurement, and we can now see, you know, since we don't know whether this method really works, whether we can benchmark it against existing data that has been taken. And so we went back to some data set that has been published a while ago from Jen Zahlen's lab, where they basically took stainings of embryos and they measured myosin II polarization as a function of different stages. And what they observe is that initially there's some, well, not very clear polarization, but it builds up. You have a lot of myosin at AP interfaces, much less so at DV, and likewise you at stage 7 have a very pronounced, very stable anisotropy. We can now do this for all of our data sets in a region that is the germ band, so as close as possible as we can get to what Todd has been measuring. And what we will then also see is that this anisotropy builds up. So this color code here basically is time, and you can see how initially polarization is weak, and by the end of 20 minutes into gastrulation, we see a very strong polarization similar to how Todd saw it, that it is low in DV and strong in AP interfaces. Yes?
So I had a question on the previous slide in the model. There's something I don't understand. The stress tensor should be, I mean, should be the sum of two things. So this myosin activity that you describe as a tensor, but as soon as you deform a material, there is a contribution which comes
ah, so okay, good, very good point. I missed saying that. So, I mean, I guess Boris is going to probably go into this a little more. However, what we are doing here is we also just assume now we're doing an instantaneous thing, right? So we take a snapshot of myosin at one time, and we want to predict the movement towards another time. And I think Boris is going to talk about this in a lot more detail in a few seconds. Okay, so the other...
Here, the pool of myosin that you're interested in is just a junctional...
We'll get to that. So we will take both pools. We will take basal pool and junctional pool.
But not medial.
We haven't taken medial yet, but medial will come to this. This is work in progress. So, yeah. Okay, so what we can now do is we can sort of... The idea has been put forth that you know, these parole genes polarize the myosin in each of these cells. And so what we can do now is we can see, can we actually match our the orientation that we would get out of our myosin polarization measurements and EVE stripes. And what you can see here is basically an image. In red, we see the nuclei. In yellow, we see even skipped stripes. And these blue little bars are the orientation that myosin would have according to our analysis.
Do you see any difference in the norm of those?
So this is the quantification here, yeah?
So there you've drawn it on the E-stripe. You're just plotting the one.
Yeah, but I mean, this is the only place where I can accurately measure this, right? In between, I don't know how Eve is oriented.
No, I know, but if you plotted those myosin lines throughout, would you see that their length was more in the E-stripe than it would be?
Oh, no. That you wouldn't see. You wouldn't see that from this measurement. Yeah, you wouldn't see that from this measurement.
Presumably, even though Eve is correlating with directionality, runt or guts would also correlate with the directionality. This whole collection of genes that are expressed in stripes are all correlating with the directionality of myosin.
Unless there are some regions of those pair segments that do accumulate more myosin. That's why I was wondering if you just made a plot of the norm just over a segment, would it change at all?
That's a good idea. I think we could do that. We could plot spatially the angle basically between these things and see whether there's a modulation along the
angle. The angle and the magnitude of the.
The amplitude you will not see here. The amplitude you won't see in this. This is just.
It's just not modulated on the time.
Yes, it's not. We will talk about the amplitude later. Yeah, we will talk about this. We will come to that later. And so over time, you can see that works relatively well until some relatively late time point where we get a disagreement that we still don't quite understand. And so now we can look at individual components.
Wait a minute. It's not, those lines aren't sort of tangent to the Eve stripe. They're
At the end, they're not tangent anymore, right? This is not tangent, and that you see also here in the plot that it's not tangent anymore. But you see these stripes are very clearly tangent,
okay.
Right? What is happening here, I don't fully understand yet.
But even at the beginning, they're not tangent, right?
Yeah. At the very beginning, they are also not tangent. They are only tangent once, myosin becomes polarized, which is around about 10 minutes. And then the average angle between myosin predicted orientation and Eve stripe is 5 degrees. And we can see that in this video, right? When you look at...
Go to these times now, I would say that it is very close to tangent.
Right? If you look here, I would say that is very close to tangent. And that you also see here in this plot, basically, that's the time where myosin is very polarized, where we can see these E stripes very reliably, and we can see that the angle, also the standard deviation, which is also telling us a lot, is becoming very small.
And maybe this alignment is actually real, and there's something else going on. But
you spoke about this.
There's a vector that can be decomposed here into a component that's parallel to the stripes and
normal.
Component, there's something else.
So. Yeah, we could analyze that in more detail. I mean, this is all very fresh. Yeah. So, okay. So now we can analyze, the temporal evolution of this myosin tensor. Along the dorsoventral axis, which you could interpret, if we think about it as a stress, as a pulling force of how strong myosin can pull on DV interfaces. And so you see that over time, it builds up, and it builds up more strongly, though, in ventral regions than in dorsal regions. So that would tell, maybe I should play it again, that... we're pulling somewhat stronger on interfaces in the ventral regions than we are pulling on the dorsal regions. And so now we can take our little toy model that we had, can we take the divergence of this myosin tensor and predict, movements in the embryo?
And I thought you mentioned just now that there's more myosin at the dorsal side.
So this is right now the apical myosin, polarized myosin, yeah? Because the basal myosin is actually not polarized, it's relatively uniform, and so it's a trace part. We could also plot that, but I didn't show this. This is just showing the apical part, and one component of this tensor, the pull basically on the dorsal ventral. We could show the off diagonal where you would see little vortices appear in the video, but I thought that.
So this is the forces responsible for ventral view.
I don't think so. I think that that is actually responsible for what germband extension would be. And, you know, in the model that we are having, that Boris will put forth now, we will basically describe how that might lead to movements of the posterior midgut. So, yeah, just to complete, you know, this very local friction-only model, we can make correlation between the predicted movements in the embryo from our myosin patterns that we see and the actual measured movements that we get out of the images. And so red means that there is a high correlation and blue means that there is a low correlation. And what I haven't shown you here is that we are working towards a transition from basal to apical.
Is there a negative correlation here?
Yeah, that's a negative correlation. It's a negative correlation. Which basically tells us that this local model in many regions works at this early time, but in some regions it fails. And as you play this over time, you begin to see that during the time when the ventral furrow goes in, it's completely crap. But at the times where, you know, the germ band actually moves, and let me stop it maybe there, here. So this is the time where the germ band moves, this posterior side. In the germ band region, it does actually not so bad. Right? It correlates very nicely. But where it really performs extraordinarily poor is in the region where the posterior midgut is moving.
It's
negatively correlating, yeah? Which means that...
It would make total sense if there were some places where you were assembling actively myosin with a certain polarity and actively contracting it, and then in other places it's being pulled on by, you know...
Yeah. You're on track. You're on track. You're on track.
Counteracted, so your blue regions could be those passive.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Nick will show some nicer plots, yeah, that might be more convincing than what we have here.
But yeah. Can I ask?
Yeah.
No, you would you expect the curvature to change a lot because this could affect your divergence?
Why should the curvature change? I'm always having a static surface.
Okay.
So there's no changes in curvature.
Can you play again this prediction?
Yes.
So why is it not always symmetric? Because I mean, the system is.
Yeah, that's a.
I mean,
okay.
Left.
Oh god. Now we're going into a problem. So it's data that we use, right? We have data, right? We record flow fields, we record myosin, and then we extract information out of this. Now our sample number is 10, which is not, you know, awesome. Yeah, you would like to have 100 or so. And so you can get asymmetries from just having a small number of data sets.
But is this just from one embryo, or is this...
No. This is an ensemble average over 10 embryos.
Oh.
So everything that I show you is always ensemble averages. We are never doing one embryo alone. That's...
But in your case, I mean, you would also just take half of this picture, right? Because you're not taking into account the interaction between the right and left.
If we just avoid the issue of right-left for the moment and folded the image over on top of itself, you would have 20 sides with this. And
yes.
Does that smooth things out?
That could well be. Yeah, that could well be that smoothens things out.
It's an issue, not a philosophical issue, but it's an issue whether that's what one wants to do. But.
One often takes these clutching coated vesicles in the textbook, they're always nice, like as a keeper, right? And you wonder, are they really so perfect? Well, actually, when one reconstructs electron microscopy, one assumes icosahedral symmetry. So one can never get an answer to the question whether there are defects. So I think the more honest thing would be actually to make many images, 100, and average them, then we move on.
Yeah, that's... It depends on what you're interested in. But yes.
It's so interesting. So it starts off with really large regions of positive and negative correlation.
Mm-hmm.
And as it evolves, they stay kind of, they break up into smaller regions. Of,
yeah. So this time, yeah, I see what you mean, right? You're thinking about this time which is prime time ventral furrow invagination. And this sort of begins to be working against us. Now, we're working on this thin little shell of the embryo. And what happens here is that a lot of cell mass goes into the embryo. And that basically it has a normal component that is non-negligible anymore. And we are neglecting it. That's why our fits round about the time of where the ventral furrow is actually happening, and you can see that here, become poor.
Go back to that image there at approximately the same time. Right there. The other question to ask is, what else is happening in the embryo that we would like to explain? You have those two diagonal lines that come to the other side, that line
that
and
line?
That line. And so a person could ask, is that the cephalic furrow? And is there a... picking up an unexpected, a previously undetected correlation between something about myosin and something about the... nobody's ever been able to really understand or implicate motor or mechanism in the cephalic furrow. So maybe you're picking that up. The little band in front of it is that the other thing that's beginning to happen is that cells in the embryo are beginning to divide again. And the first area to divide is that little red area at the end, that little red area in front of the cephalic furrow. And maybe there's some aspect of myosin distributions that your analogy, that your approach is picking up there, even though you may have deliberately designed it to do that, but there's some change in myosin distribution or intensity associated with cell division that you pick up with the, when an epithelial cell divides, the cell, those that patches those cells shorten and round up and come up to the surface, and the surface then changes its shape. So there could be lots of things going on here that were actually reproducibly, if you do make the 100 movies, you get the same pattern, because reproducibly you're detecting two subtle things and correlating one subtle thing with another subtle thing, and we see those patterns emerging.
So, to the extent that right now we're staring at the comparison of the model and the data, and this is sort of just the first crack at the modeling, maybe we should postpone interpreting the redness rule until we have a better model.
Yes.
And the patterns will change a little bit, but this is sort of a very interesting conversation of what exactly is captured and what is missed in the process.
Do you have a scale for your color map?
It's minus one to
one. Minus 1 to 1. Perfect correlation is red, perfect anticorrelation is blue.
Wow.
And sign is something in between.
Okay.
0.
Okay.
But you're correlating your myosin answer to is the deformation of those little squares?
So what we have is the flow field, right? And we can calculate the divergence of this myosin tensor and then correlate. So this is going to be a vector, and then we can correlate with that vector.
Okay.
But you use only junction analyzing.
No, so that's I was going to describe right now. So what we can do is we can take our total myosin and say that we sweep through a composition of the basal and the apical myosin. We cannot really, put them just together, but what we could try to do is sort of ask how strongly are they weighted. Yeah, so we have a little weighting factor in front of these, and then say which one of the two populations of myosin that we've now measured, basal pool of myosin versus apical pool of myosin, is dominating the movement that we are observing in this video. And so what we are observing here is the average fit quality. And so in blue, you can see the basal myosin pool. In red, you can see the apical pool of myosin. And in green, you can see the best fit, which is chosen for some alpha value. Yeah? And so the average alpha value here is basically 0.661, which means in this region, the best fit is dominated by the basal myosin pool. And in this region here, we see that this value essentially is close to zero, which means that the best fit is dominated by the apical myosin pool, yeah? Which sort of suggests that we may have a transition in the embryo from initially basally driven deformations to apically driven deformations.
So if I understand right, you're projecting all the myosin you have from apical and basal on one single plane, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But maybe they're doing different things. For instance, in the ventral cells, the fact that you have probably less myosin too and more apically would create a torque in order to allow cells to be internalized. So the fact that they're spatially localized in different places really has a function in changing the shape of the embryo. So projecting everything on one plane, seems a bit. Would you take one of these acellular embryos, which will simplify your life?
Yeah, we can
do that. Network and then see if it works.
So yes, we can do this. But you know, we'll take this. I think this is now a good point, right? You're all sort of criticizing this local model for very good reasons, because it only works in very specific regions, and there are things to be concerned. You know, we get like 66% correlation. There's still a lot of correlation missing. And so let's see whether, you know, we can actually understand why, for example, we have this very poor correlation on the posterior midgut region. Yeah, and I think that Boris will put forth a change to this view that hopefully then becomes a little more convincing that we can actually do what you, you know, rightfully criticize. And you know, whether it is correct around the times of ventral furrow is still something that we have to debate. Yeah. So. Do you want to
pull up the screen, so this please?
Oh, yeah, I'll pull up some screen.
That's all the lights.
So the truth is that the only reason I'm appearing here is because Sebastian said that he didn't have time to prepare slides with equations, and because I didn't have time to prepare slides with equations, there are no new slides.
Right. I'm going to hook it up. Take this off. And light.
Okay. So,
in fact, just going back to Matteo's question of, you know, there are different pools of myosins, and we're adding this myosin and that myosin. Don't think of it that we're adding apples and oranges there. What's really being said is that stress is generated by myosin. And you may ask, well, so first of all, why is stress generated by myosin? Well, sort of plausible. But then it's entirely possible that what basal myosin contributes to a relevant part of the stress is different from what, did I say basal? Right? From what apical myosin contributes to the stress. But already somebody before asked, why is it that we're saying that stress tensor is proportional to myosin tensor? It's not really obvious. So anyway, I will just set things up a little bit. So we have cells. So we have many cell processes. Right, so here are my little cells. And so basically think that you're looking at the tissue here at, you know, 63x, or maybe 100x. And what we want to understand is this morphogenetic flow. And that's happening, let's say, at 10x. And we'll describe this flow as flow. right, displacement of cells over time at some very coarse, crude resolution where you perhaps don't even resolve cells, right? And so here we heard from Suzanne and Johannes the many processes contributing. There are these T1s and elongations of cells or deformations of cells, you know, the dreaded correlations, and you know, myosin and cation, and there's a lot of stuff going on, and it can be very complicated. But you know, we're physicists, we're simple people, so we want to shove all of this into a black box, cover it up, and call it, you know, force generation. And somehow it's this force generation that we think defines the flow in some way. And what's worse, we actually think that the flow, okay, so I guess I should have said that what cells do is controlled by genes and the patterns of genes, and now we're, right, so these same genes therefore control force generation, and that generates the flow, and now we think that maybe the flow mechanics actually has some feedback into generation of forces. So what's generating forces on some level? Right, we believe that it's myosin, and myosin is polarized, so we describe it as a tensor. So this dreaded object, and so Sebastian was already talking about tensors. So my question is, should I do sort of a 3-minute tutorial on tensors without tears? So when Madhav was giving a little math tutorial the other day in the evening, she asked the audience, does everybody know what the vector is? And somebody very quickly said, yes, a vector is a little piece of DNA that you use to transfer genes. So similar. Okay. Should I do it?
Tensors
or
how we
okay.
feel at the end of a lot of talks.
Excuse me?
Tensor is how we feel at a lot after a lot of
Okay. So
draw it right down.
Do it.
Okay, fine. So Sebastian was using this tensor notion to describe myosin polarization. So suppose you have myosin filaments like that, and myosin filaments like that. And I'll call this x-axis, and I call this the y-axis. So what we'll write is something, we'll describe this by a matrix with the elements here, which are going to be mxx, mxy, myx, and myy. And in this particular situation, right, if there's a lot of myosin here, and a little myosin there, this thing simply will have two non-zero numbers. There'll be a big number here and a small number there, and this will be zero. And the way you relate the dreaded tensor to not-so-dreaded vectors is basically by you can do this through some different constructions. So suppose somebody gives you a bunch of vectors. So I have you know, one vector and another vector. And what I'm going to do is I'll add kind of a mirror image here and a mirror image there. Yeah, I'm going to make this a little bit simpler. Like that. And so these are vectors, so they have some components. Again, my x and y axis. And what we can do arithmetically is construct the following object. Right, multiply the A component of this vector by its B component, which could also be the same. Right, it could be X and X. And I do this again here. Excuse me. This was supposed to be V and V. And I'll call this now a tensor with I made the matrix, so I defined entries in an object like this, and we'll call this a tensor, and that's basically all there is to it. So the meaning of this is the following. So in fact, if I average over these entities, this describes an ellipsoid like that. So there is a sense in which this matrix defines the shape. And if we put in more sticks in here, right, we add more vectors, right, we'll just add all of them up, average, and that's, what did I do? That was not good. Yeah, I want all of these things go through the same. Oh, pardon me. Right. They'll pass through that origin. And now the meaning of the ellipsoid that's described by this matrix or tensor is so the shape of defined by this bunch of points, right? And effectively, this is how Sebastian makes tensors out of little sticks of Meissen that he identifies in this radon transform.
So there could be a lot of different combinations of those vectors that could give you the same...
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right? This is just... exactly. But if all you want to know is the anisotropy of the shape, you'll be very happy to have only three numbers, because this is equal to that, to worry about. Right? We want a simple description. Yes?
Just for the very simple...
You know what tensors are. You're not
no, for the very simple things, the big ones and the small ones, the X and Ys,
yeah.
Shouldn't you switch them?
What?
In your simple Meissen that has the much Meissen on the Y direction.
It's the other way around.
It should be...
Just I said, you know what they are. All right. Fine. Meissen, stress. So for stress, as Sebastian said, if this board was a big piece of rubber and my chalk was a knife, I could cut through it and so put some sort of a fancy dynamometer in here and measure the force. So we would describe this little imaginary surface. Here you see only a line by a normal. And then we would ask, what's the, so if this is x direction, so the force acting on the surface would be described by two numbers, right, by a row of this matrix. Sigma xx, sigma xy, right? And similarly for the y surface, it would be that, okay? So what do I mean by this? So think of clapping your hands. So I clap my hands and so what's the stress acting on my palms? When I clap, it's the normal stress. Palms, that's normal stress. So if this is x, then we're looking at sigma xx. If I rub my hands, so this is clapping. And this is rubbing. Right? Traction. Okay. And now, just as Sebastian said, if you want to calculate the force that's acting on some element of an elastic medium. So it has a surface, right? The surface locally has a direction. And we integrate over the surface, right? And right, locally stress acts some, so defines this force, normal and traction. So now we have to sum up over what stresses are doing all over the surface. And that will give us the total force acting on this bit of material. And that's basically volume times divergence of the stress. Okay? That was more than 3 minutes, so that's
okay.
Yeah, don't ask any questions.
A great man once said, "We are flexible, but we are not infinite."
That's my problem. I shouldn't have done that. Okay. So, I talked 10 minutes about this. Now I have 5 minutes to talk about the rest. Okay, so our question is still, we have this Meissen stress, and we have Meissen distribution, and we have stress, and you know, physicists will just say, okay, we got two tensors, so they are so proportional to each other, and you know, why would we say a thing like this? And the second question is, I was just describing the stress, making references to sheets of rubber and elastic solids, and what is tissue? Is it solid or a fluid? So, of course, the correct answer is neither. It's neither solid nor fluid. Now, I'd like to argue that it's that it's a creepy solid. So in fact, I'd say that it's an active creepy solid. So let's zoom in 100x. We're going to look at whatever individual cells. We are going to represent cells by polygons. You know about vertex models. We define corners of these polygons. We define positions of these polygons. We can define length of edges of cells. And we can write down some sort of elastic energy, mechanical energy, which is basically going to treat each edge here as a little Hookean spring. So there is the actual length of a spring, and there is an internal length of, so the rest length of a spring, right? So Rij is what this distance is, and Lij is what this distance wants to be. And then we'll sum over all the edges, and then we'll also say that there is some area per cell, and it's also important. Okay, so then we'll say that what these vertices want to do, they want to move, they want to move in such a way as to minimize mechanical energy. And so this gives us the force acting on every vertex, and we'll balance it by friction. So that's just a boring regular solid. What makes it creepy is we'll say that actually this stuff here also has dynamics. And now we go to some super resolution, and we'll look here And what we see is a bunch of actin filaments. And there are molecular motors, myosins, walking along them. And now I have this whole little filament. It's under tension. So a very important thing, I haven't defined tension here. So I would define tension of a filament, of course, as a Hookean spring, just as actual length minus the intrinsic length. Okay, fine. So this is my L. And now we want to say that these myosins will walk and contract the filament if they can, which is to say if the load is not too high. So we're going to say that L dot, that's contractility, depends on tension per myosin molecule, right? And this is some number. And let's make it equal to 1. So that's basically the picture. So I'm going to write down another equation here, which then says Lij. Why do I have to pick the shortest piece of chalk? Yeah. I'm not going to put these indices because you're going to get confused with tensors. So this is saying that if there is more myosin than tension, then the filament will contract. If there is more tension than myosin, then it's going to slide and elongate. Okay? And the last thing that you can imagine is that the myosin itself has dynamics. You might be recruiting stuff onto the filament. And in fact, that's very interesting because that's where we think this mechanical feedback might be operating. But I'm already operating on minus 5 minutes. So this is interesting. Okay. It's interesting, but we don't have time for it. So now what I basically like to say is the following. Now, suppose this mechanical relaxation process is very, very fast. So it adjusts the length so fast that this is approximately equal to 0. So instantaneously, all the tensions acting here are almost balanced. Okay? So you have to say this is fast. But this will say slow. So even as the tensions are almost balanced, the little bit that they are not balanced, right? So if myosin is not exactly equal to the tension there, tension then has to adjust until the right-hand side here also becomes 0. Right? So now, to the extent that this is approximately 0, you have tension proportional to myosin. Okay, this tension is defined just in a little line. If we generalize this to into two dimensions, this will turn into some sort of a statement like this. I'm sorry, with tensors.
Sigma.
Okay, sorry. Right? So that's really our justification for thinking that knowing myosin tensor tells you something about the stress. Because that's what it takes to stall all the myosins locally. There was a question?
So going back to the model you've shown, what you assume, so you assume that the velocity field is proportional to the divergence of the stress tensor. So you assume that there is a lot of friction
and
no viscous type of, so okay. Friction will dominate over viscous type of dissipation. That's a strong approximation. Or strong, not approximation, a strong assumption.
Well, hey.
and who knows? What should we do?
Yeah, just one sec. Just one sec. We're going to do hypothesis-driven research here. So, what did I do? Okay. So you can basically trivially generalize this by saying, okay, now we're going to zoom out, 10x continuum approximation. And now our elastic energy is going to be written in terms of two tensors. So this one defines, so I'm just going to generalize this R minus L squared. So now if we look at some points in the media, and they are displaced a little bit, whatever they are displaced, you know, this metric tensor describes the actual physical displacement of the points, think of them cells, from you know, where they were before, right? So we'll call this delta r's, and they are functions of position, right? And so spatial derivatives of this field define this tensor, right? And this tensor tells us where, okay, this is where cells are, and this is where cells want to be. Right? So we just generalize this 1D picture into a 2D picture. And the only other generalization basically going to be, we'll generalize this equation. We'll say that the internal structure of the tissue described by this object as the dynamics which is just a two-dimensional generalization of what I had before. So in fact, right, I already gave away this punchline. So we minimize this energy instantaneously. We say that the tissue is in mechanical equilibrium, and then we say that, right, this is our creep equation. And then we say the dynamics is governed by this. And at the end of the day, we have related the flow field to the Meissen field. Because the stress is determined by minimizing elastic energy. I think maybe I have decoupled.
Could you say something very qualitatively about how this is not a viscoelastic? What is the singular? I mean, we've talked, right? So,
yeah. So, fine. So, I need to hand this off to Nick for the punchline. And my handoff point is to write the following equation. So, I'm actually very annoyed at both of you because you used the this
don't
U
change,
for
change V. Change. Don't be annoyed. Don't be annoyed.
Well, at midnight it was U.
Yeah, so
it's V now. So this is the flow field, and there is some crazy equation which basically says that the Laplacian of this V field, the velocity field, is the gradient of the divergence of this field, and okay, how am I going to write this? I'm going to write the gradient dotted into M tensor, sort of two-headed beast. Okay, so that's the magic equation there is basically Young modulus, which some corners were cut here. So strictly speaking, mechanical response can be different in shear mode like this, or for that matter, forming, while preserving the area. And the bulk modulus, where we compress or stretch without changing the shape. So B is the stiffness of the material to this compressive response. Okay? So to answer Madhav's question, incompressible viscous fluid here corresponds to a very large bulk modulus. So basically, you cannot compress at all. That will be exactly forced viscous fluid. And of course, this term, right, is the Laplacian, so this is the viscosity-like term. But they come, right, but this effectively viscous behavior doesn't mean that underlying material is a fluid. Right? For example, we know that, I think Suzanne was showing this, so if you have some tissue and you come and ablate, it's actually very easy to ablate on the blackboard, this stuff will shrink and the outside is going to expand because there is tension inside, right? And that's sort of the part of tension which was in mechanical equilibrium. It was balanced until it was cut, right? And the fluid, you would not have anything like this. And it has actually a bunch of other interesting and sometimes exotic properties that Madhav and Itse and Nick and Sebastian had some fun with, but we don't have time. Nick.
In the interest of time, I'll go pretty briefly, but you can ask me afterwards, and also so we don't get lost too much more in the weeds. But okay, so Boris kind of explained how we could get this equation, and really then all you do is you take a mesh, a triangulation, and you work to represent these type of vector operators and tensors on that mesh. And what you'll get is you'll get a big matrix equation, a matrix times the velocity field is equal to the divergence of the Meissen field that Sebastian can measure. And then you can ask, how close is that predicted velocity field as a function of bulk modulus to the observed velocity field? Okay? And here I'm just going to show you, I think this is roughly 20 minutes after cephalic furrow formation, the predicted flow field. And this is simply from inverting this equation, and it's a very large bulk modulus, taken to be something like 100. And you'll notice that all of the fixed point structure emerges entirely from just the Meissen field observed. So, and then you can construct similar correlation plots that Sebastian showed, and you see pretty much everywhere except for at the poles and at all of the fixed points of the flow, you do pretty damn well. And we can get into why there's some sustained blue regions around the fixed points in a second. Okay? So here it is in a two-dimensional cut. It's easier to see all in one picture. And you see kind of, this is now 14 minutes, the spatial structure. And so the reason you get these extended blue regions is simply because you're not actually predicting the position of fixed points precisely. So in the region where they're in between, let's say green is predicted and black is actual, you have a region of anti-correlation here, just because they're pointing in opposite directions. So the spatial extent of blue gives you a kind of rough estimate for how closely you're predicting fixed points. So this, I think, is roughly 10 microns in size, and this is roughly, this is 10, this is roughly 30. So, you know, you're doing pretty well at this particular time point. And I can play you a movie here. You get to see spatial structure, and then you see it slowly emerge. So early on, I think we can look back again. So again, during the ventral furrow formation, it kind of goes to pot here. And that's probably because things are moving in three dimensions, and we're trying to approximate it as a two-dimensional flow. Okay. And this was the plot that Sebastian put up, which is just taking the divergence of a local Meissen tensor. And this is the correlation you get doing this kind of more active model. So you see, during germ band extension, it sits about 0.93 median correlation everywhere. And over here, so you can't see green. Green is the best bit, but it sits right behind red. And red's over here at about 0.9. So you do everywhere pretty well, except for in this white box, which, you know, we have a couple ideas about what could be going wrong. One that's moving in three dimensions. One that's simply a incompressible viscous fluid model might not be correct. So yeah, that's all I guess I want to say.
Nick, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
What is the difference between doing this correlation, which is this equation with a bulk modulus, and on the right-hand side, a divergence of the Meissen field, and what Sebastian showed us, which was just V. So just at an intuitive level. I mean, I understand.
Yeah. Obviously, so intuitive. Okay, so I guess I could go back to this equation.
Right.
This, if this was true, and this just worked everywhere,
right,
it means that you could just take a cut on the embryo and look at Meissen and be able to predict the flow entirely, because this is entirely local. I don't need to know anything about what's going on elsewhere in the embryo. If I invert something like this, which is called a Laplacian operator, yeah, it involves the entire embryo. So the fact that this type of model correlates and predicts the flow much better, right, tells you, and this is somewhat intuitive, right? I mean, you would imagine if you enrich, let's say, the ventral side in just a lot of Meissen, you would predict that a flow would happen, you know, from dorsal to ventral. So in some senses, this is somewhat intuitive, but it almost makes this point.
So this is what Suzanne was saying, right? Because some areas might be local, active, and some are being pushed or pulled by other regions.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, so the thing I should have drawn attention to is that if we go to this movie and we look during germ band, the one thing Sebastian could not predict is posterior midgut,
right? Exactly.
And here we see exactly. So in some senses, it tells you the posterior midgut might not be driving the flow, but responding to forces elsewhere.
To what extent does it matter that at the moment, if I understand correctly, you are incorporating apical junctional Meissen or basal accumulated non-pattern, non-polarized Meissen, and are not incorporating these patches of isotropic Meissen distributions like in the posterior midgut or in the ventral furrow? So if you imagine incorporating them in, what would happen to the data presentation and the models that you're dealing with?
I guess the first simple-minded way I can think about it is just treating like a third pool of Meissen. And you have two coefficients that you need to predict. You have the contribution of the basal pool, the contribution of the apical pool, and the contribution of the medial pool. And that might actually fix this correlation you observe, for instance, during ventral furrow. That's one way to incorporate.
So would you ever lose the blue? I mean, Suzanne's intuitive understanding of the blue was that was passive being, it was the negative, you know, the issue of the negative toilet? Are you going to lose the blue? Is the ideal to have everything be red? Because we now incorporated
the rules of my answer. If it's all red,
we're going to lose, and therefore we'll lose all negative correlation.
Yes.
Your
goal would be to exactly predict the flow. And if you're going to exactly predict the flow, it should just, I mean, for all times, you should just see a red square, which would be a boring movie, but it means that you actually predict something. So, I mean, the blue, I would say, is basically a failure of the model. And it's because you're trying to treat it as just a homogeneous material.
So maybe if I can paraphrase what you're saying is, so there are some well-known processes that do not seem to be accounted for, yet there seems to be a great deal of agreement even without that, right?
Yeah.
So, okay, so there are two bits. One is, 0.93 is pretty good, but one can eventually, so more than we expected, but one can hope to get better. But another thing is, in both cases, the missing processes are also associated with three-dimensional deformation. So it looks like fortuitously, perhaps, because the agreement is so damn good without it, what's happening is, that the medial myosin is mostly busy
doing
the deforming out of the plane. And since we're not even trying to fit that, we don't have to worry about it. Now, to the extent that some of that process is going to also contribute to movement what's happening in two dimensions, we certainly hope to go the remaining 7%. Right. So, and one of the simple ways of incorporating this is just to say, okay, so there are these folds, and stuff is allowed to go into the fold. Right? Well, they can incorporate that in the mechanics model. And so that's sort of the ambition to do a little better.
So you mean you could just sort of make that fold modulus really small, so where if you were just treating it as a surface, you could...
We had this little discussion. That is probably the hard way of doing it. So the easier way of doing it is just to, it depends on your level of ambition, right? So like ideally, you would really like to do sort of three-dimensional mechanics, right? And it can be done. You don't have to worry about buckling and thickness of the layer. I don't think we can just do it with bulk modulus in 2D. So I think if we start on that path, we'll have to do a bit more. But so Fuhrmann's version would be just, okay, put in a cut and allow stuff to go in, right? And so the crazy thing is, at the moment, it's a model with no parameters, except for this fudge factor, which shifts attention from basal pool to, but I guess even that may disappear as a fitting parameter.
There's also the bulk modulus, but this doesn't make much of a difference. I mean, you go to higher and higher bulk modulus.
Well, I guess it's
regional differences.
Yeah, you're basically hitting regional differences at some point.
I guess maybe one more remark. So we were talking about non-locality in this model and friction. So if you want to put friction, just add another term with friction times velocity, right? And what Nick finds is that it doesn't help us. The, if you like, the viscous term, the Laplacian there takes care of, right? So that in itself is already non-local. As you said, that forces you to solve equation everywhere. But that's not enough. There is also incompressibility, which...
So incompressibility was the word that we've been bitterly arguing about for the past week, and what what it really means is, well, where it becomes an interesting issue is when things leave the plane of the analysis and go some out of that plane, they, in the words that these guys like to use, that cell is compressible, and when material for some reason or another does not leave the plane, this is my interpretation of what the word I say, does not leave the plane. We think of this as incompressible material. We apply a descriptive word that is incompressible, and then as long as we're dealing with much of this becomes interpretable in terms of incompressible because surface areas of individual cells aren't changing because stuff isn't leaving or folding.
But all it has to do is just get longer apical basal and narrower. Of course it could be incompressible.
Right. So it could be, but it's an empirical fact.
Yeah.
It's an empirical fact. It's not.
It's long. So that's the statement. The observed flow is, at later stages, is effectively incompressible.
So if you made
calculated
just from the observed flow fields, the compression and expansion, you would say nothing would change except at the
rotational part is much bigger than irrotation.
So the issue in part is that the things that produce compressible flows, that is, flows out of the plane, are the apical medial myosin that we're specifically not incorporating into the model. And changing is not the physical properties of the cytoplasm, in a way, but whether we consider force generating machines that are capable of compressing the surface and moving cytoplasm out of the surface. Neither basal myosin contraction will compress the apical surface, apparently, or a lateral polarized junctional myosin will compress the apical surface. The only thing that can compress the apical surface are this medial myosin population in each cell that constricts the apical surface and leads to visible compressibility. So it's essentially whether we even want to incorporate medial myosin into the model, because it's going to make everything much more complicated.
Coming back to the remark, Boris, the question I have is about this friction. So if you had this friction, then you can define a hydrodynamic length. And so have you been able to evaluate a little bit what would be this hydrodynamic length compared to the cell size, and if it makes any sense?
Remember, we're not really starting with any rheological measurements. I think what you want is us to really try to understand the biophysics of this creepy medium, and we're trying to avoid that. Right? Mm-hmm. We're trying to say that, so here is a phenomenological equation, and I'm going to insist on using the word, which has some logic that goes into it. And there are some terms, not too many. And now it's not too difficult to just scan, search, three parameters. So add your friction there, add viscosity, and ask, do you gain anything from adding friction? The answer is no.
Which means that friction is negligible.
Precisely, that's the statement.
So how do you make that?
Yeah, so presumably, right. But this is not, I thought you wanted to start from microscopy.
Okay, I think.
Thanks very much. This is a fantastic discussion, and I think this discussion will keep going. We will now keep going in coffee. thank you very much, Dr. for the presenters. Thanks very much.